On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the summer of 2007, high-profile killings in Newark and Oakland and Connecticut have put bloody murder back in the headlines. But here's the rub with crime and punishment in America. Crime peaked in 1992 in this country, while prison populations have continued to explode. The United States now has the highest incarceration rate in the world, many times higher than peer nations. And now, murder rates in American cities have jumped again. So, has locking up millions made America safer? And how far can the lockup go? Up next on Point, millions in prison, blood in the streets. What now? Joining me today in the studio is Glenn Lowry, prominent social critic and professor of economics at Brown University. He is the author of the cover story in this month's Boston Review, Why Are So Many Americans in Prison? Race and the Transformation of Criminal Justice. Glenn Lowry, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
With us from New York is Paul Butler, a former federal prosecutor of corruption, drug, and gun cases in Washington, D.C. He's now a law professor at George Washington University. Paul Butler, thank you very much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Tom.
Paul Butler, let's go first to you. You know, there's a hue and cry. People want relief from this, particularly in urban centers where murder is driving folks crazy right now. We've seen violent crime rates go down in this country and then some uptick. I'm reading here in cities of over a million, up 6.7% in the latest number that I've seen. It's not in every city, but there's clearly too much of it at the same time as we have these jammed prison. What's going on here? Why isn't all this incarceration solving the violent crime problem?
Well, in part, it's because the increase in incarceration hasn't so much been violent criminals, but it's been people who are nonviolent, especially people accused of drug crimes. And so they're not the people who are making us feel so unsafe on the streets. A lot of people think, and I think Professor Lowry does a good job of articulating why, that it's really been this idea of punishment. We want to be punitive. We want to kind of have a bad attitude about people who commit crimes, not so much for public safety reasons, but for other political kinds of reasons.
But you've been the federal prosecutor. Surely, when there's a crime, you want to put people in prison, criminals in prison.
Well, we want to do what's best for public safety, and sometimes that means putting people in prison, Tom, and sometimes it doesn't. But the politics of it now is that whenever anybody makes a transgression, we want to lock them up, and we feel that that's the best thing for social interests, and those social interests aren't just, again, public safety, but sometimes there are other kinds of things that we want to do. And frankly, rehabilitation is very difficult. We take a guy who's going around, a stick-up boy, going around victimizing other people, and I think a lot of us want to do right by both that guy and society. We want to stop him from doing that. But it turns out to be real difficult and expensive to find ways to make him stop committing crimes. We know how to do it. The question is if we have the political will and if we're willing to devote the economic resources, which start way before prison. They really start with early education, with prenatal care, health care, all kinds of complicated things that we don't want to talk about. So it's much easier to talk about putting them in a box for 15 or 20 years.
Glenn Lowry, we're going to go to Newark and hear from people who have dealt with that horrible execution-style murder there and the fear that goes on there. We've talked before on this show with Cory Booker, the young black mayor of Newark, who's right in the thick of this. We've seen him since those murders, those horrible murders, on the air saying he's enraged, and you could see it. At the same time, he sat down with Bob Herbert at the New York Times recently. Bob asked him, you know, what's the solution to this problem? And the enraged mayor said, it's not law enforcement. But we've got sort of mixed impulses here because the sheriff down there, Armando Fontura, lost it last week, kind of said, I'm on the verge of telling my guys to suspend civil liberties, start frisking everybody, you know, throw everybody in the slammer. We've got sort of contradictory impulses right there in Newark.
Well, people's children are being shot in the back of the head. I mean, people are afraid. These are terrible events. I mean, there's no gainsaying that. These are bad things that are happening. And so in our rage and our fear, we're sometimes moved to do things that might not be wise from the long term. I mean, you don't make policy based on your gut in a situation like this. You look at the evidence, you look at the history, and you try to make, you know, prudent and sensible public moves. So suspending civil liberties is obviously something we don't want to have happening in our cities in response to a rash of violence. And I would argue that locking them up and throwing away the key has shown itself also not to be the solution to this problem, although it's an impulse that's easily understandable.
What about those who say, all right, we had, and you write it yourself in the Boston Review, you know, we're from the 60s to the early 90s, we had this up train of crime. Then somewhere along the way, a lot more incarceration kicked in this country, and those crime statistics did fall. We've got an uptick now, and we've got some very bloody headlines. But crime came way down in a lot of cities and is still down in a lot of cities. So what makes you so sure that incarceration's the wrong way to go?
Well,
or
you know,
mega incarceration.
The numbers and the details matter.
Yes, please.
Yes, of course, crime is down. Is it down because of the uptick in incarceration? One can look at this carefully, and the social scientists who have done have concluded, even those who are relatively friendly toward the punitive side of things, that only about 25% of the dramatic fall in crime that we've seen since the early 1990s can be attributed to this rise in incarceration.
What's the rest of it?
Well, the rest of it is a variety of factors, and we don't really know. For example, the economist Stephen Levitt has gotten into trouble by suggesting that perhaps the advent of abortion had indirectly had some influence on the
decline
in crime.
Fewer unwanted children,
fewer
criminals.
That's the argument. It's a demographic argument. There is some evidence for it, although it's extremely controversial. I'm just trying to say these are very difficult things to understand. We don't know why it goes up. We don't necessarily know why it comes down. But the role of prisons in it is the relatively minor part of what's been happening.
Let's hear from our listeners, and we're going to hear a lot more from you as well. Let's take a call from Shelby, North Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Please stay on the line.
Hello, David. Are you there?
Yes, I am, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. You're on the air, sir. What do you think?
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start off by saying that the caller before me stole a lot of my thunder, but I would like to say that I don't know all the answers to the questions. I'm not even sure about some of the questions, but I understand there are 2 million people incarcerated in this country. It's the highest in the civilized world. I don't think that we want to see this country if you turn all those 2 million people loose. If we have to build more prisons, I guess I'll just have to pay my share. But rehabilitation is shaky at best.
So how much is too much, though, David? Is there a point at which, you know, you say, okay, we've got jammed prisons, but we've still got murders. Maybe that's not the answer, or not?
It's kind of like saying how much water is there in a bucket. I don't have the answer to that question. We're doing the best we can. The law enforcement people are doing the best they can, and it seems like it's escalating. We must put a stop to it somehow. Killing children in the streets is the same.
David, thank you very much for your call. Glenn Lowry, you make a big, deep case behind your observations on the prisons. You tie it right back to race. And, you know, the way I read you, you say it's turned into a kind of a racial gulag or a kind of criminal justice apartheid. I don't know how you want to describe it. But then there's David saying, boy, what if they're not there, these criminals?
Well, you know, the thing is, they are going to get out. I mean, it's not the same 2 million. It's 2.25 million now, and they're going to get out. We don't hold them forever. 2/3 of them are not violent offenders. They're drug offenders and property offenders. No one is saying that you should let mass murderers walk around on the street. But when you compare the United States to other comparable countries, I'm talking about in Northern Europe, for example, the rates of incarceration, the length of our sentences, the punitiveness of our system is vastly greater.
6 times the rate of Canada, almost 8 times of France, 12 times the rate of Japan.
Some of these countries have serious crime problems of their own.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the issue here is not that we should not respond to this problem. The issue is how we're going to respond to it. Prison is only one arrow in our quiver. And as Paul Butler said earlier, I think we have to look at longer-term kinds of interventions, and we have to look at root causes. Now, I know that that's in bad order. You know, that's a liberal phrase to talk about the root causes of crime. But if you create criminogenic conditions in the center of your great cities— if you have huge public housing projects in which there are concentrated poor people, if you have large ghettos that are basically abandoned to the society and left to their own devices, pathology is going to flourish there. That's not any surprise. And if we don't want the pathology, we have to get rid of the underlying conditions that generate it.
Paul Butler, you were the federal prosecutor. That the perspective that Glenn just shared was one that we heard for many years while crime was going up. That was a very prominent way of looking at it, and yet crime went up. You know, and it may not be a direct cause and effect, but it went up until incarcerations went up, and then it did come down. So is Glenn right to point to root causes? Should we lay off the imprisonment accelerator?
Well, I think he's correct when he says that incarceration is one reason why crime went down, but it's not the most important reason. But Tom, you know, you started out asking about race, mm-hmm. and I think we have to be very careful when we look at the role that race plays in this mass incarceration phenomenon. There are many African-American prosecutors, police officers, probation officers, and judges who've actually contributed to the mass incarceration of black people. I should know, I was one of them. And we believe that what we were doing was in the best interest of the community.
Do you still?
Well, now I have doubts about it. But I do know that historically the black community has been denied many resources. And one of the most important resources we didn't have was law enforcement. You know, if there was a white victim, the police were plenty interested. But that's not most of the crime that affects the African-American community. Black-on-black crime, historically, the attitude of the police has been, let them kill each other, frankly. So now, when there is this intense police presence and law enforcement interest in our community, if we don't see that as progress, then we have to articulate why it isn't.
We're talking this hour about crime and punishment in America, why we have jammed prisons and high-profile, violent crime. Is there something wrong when we are one of the world's most imprisoning countries, maybe the most? Is this about race? Have we turned the criminal justice system into a gulag for the disadvantaged, a gulag that turns out more criminals? Or is it simple to you? Do the crime, do the time. High-profile crimes in Oakland, of course, and in Newark, of course, in Connecticut, the home invasion there with all the murder that came in the mayhem that transpired out of that. In Cheshire, Connecticut, yesterday, the town where a mother and her two daughters were murdered during a home invasion, 3 weeks ago, 300 people turned out for a rally to call for tougher sentencing for repeat offenders. From WTNH-TV, here's one speaker at the rally.
We are in full support of enacting strong three-strikes law legislation with a mandatory sentence here in the state of Connecticut.
Mandatory sentence, three strikes. That's more prison. I want to turn to Newark, New Jersey right now, and Minister Thomas Ellis. He's founder and president of the Enough is Enough Coalition there. It's an anti-violence group. He founded the first chapter of Enough is Enough in Atlanta in 1993. He was shot multiple times in a robbery in Atlanta in 1997. Minister Ellis, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, yes. Thank you for having me.
So there you are, right in the middle of the whirlwind. It's been a hard time in Newark, and our sympathies are with that city and what it's been going through. How do you look at this question of jammed prisons and violent crime? What's wrong with this picture?
Well, what's wrong with this picture is we see in too many instances across the country in too many cities that many of the people have no respect for life and the living. That will cover the instance of the gun violence and shooting and stabbing incident. The part about the jails and incarceration, well, we know that if you're locking people up for open beers and jaywalking and so forth and so on, the prison system used to be in to the rehabilitation aspect, but now it's pretty much into recruiting. And what I mean when I say recruiting, a lot of these people who get arrested for these minor frivolous offenses, they may not be involved in a gang or join a gang. They just may got happen to be caught with an open beer. But when they get to the prison, guess what? They have to join up with somebody for their own protection. And so now the jail has in some form become a recruiting tool for gang members.
But you're the founder of Enough is Enough, and we hear exactly what you're saying. But at the same time, how do you read the mood in Newark right now? Are people saying, let's go easier, or, you know, let's round them up, lock them up, whoever the they may be there?
Well, what the people are saying now is enough is enough. And they're saying that in the aspects of now wanting to come together, community, clergy, police, and politicians. And that's going to be the solution to the problem, is that we have to come together all on one accord to address the issue of guns and violence. And so now we see from this last tragic incident where people before took a stand back approach, well, it wasn't my child or it's not my daughter, I'm not going to get involved. But I think this incident moved people, it galvanized people to now say we have to do more. And so the responsibility lies on the people. I say this all the time, that if the people were more active where they live, you see, you don't have to go way across town to try to solve a problem when you got a problem in your own backyard.
Mm-hmm. Thomas Ellis, please stand by. Let me take this to Paul Butler. Paul, you were the federal prosecutor. Now, the minister who's right there in Newark says the prison system is turning into a recruiting system for crime. But, you know, there was this big theory that was widely applied, the sort of broken window theory. He says don't go after guys with open beer or minor crimes. But the theory, as I understand it, was, you know, don't ignore minor crime because that will just put people on a path or lead to major crime. So a lot of people ended up in prison. Was that wrong? Should we be more lenient about minor crime? Will that really give us, you know, a better situation at the sort of bloody top of the crime pyramid?
Well, what Broken Windows was about is social disorder. So the idea that lots of things in poor communities contribute to a sense of unwell-being. One of those is crime. Another is pollution. Another is bad health care. The problem with the way that the policy got enacted is we focused too much on locking people up, and we didn't focus enough on other ways to make communities feel whole. So I think the idea that the minister articulated that prison now has become something of a finishing school for criminals. So you put these nonviolent, especially drug offenders, in there, and they come out having learned how to be really good bad guys, really good crooks. So, you know, I think if prison was more rehabilitative, then there wouldn't be as many concerns about sending people there because we'd understand that once they got out, they were better. But now, again, it's just locking up a bunch of guys in a box for 5 years or 10 years. So we really shouldn't expect a good result when they come out.
Let's take a call from Austin, Texas. John, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, how you doing?
Pretty good.
I'd like to address this idea of the minor crimes leading to major crimes. I think it's insanity to be jailing nonviolent offenders, and if things like vice were legalized and taxed and regulated, you could use the proceeds for first-rate education programs against doing drugs and first-rate rehabilitation programs. And
so legalize drugs, I don't know what else, and we'll be fine.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, I think it's been proven, just like prohibition of alcohol led to the gangster problem, that the illegalization of drugs funds an underground criminal network, and it's mostly drug users who are out there doing crimes to support their habits.
John, we will look at that. Let us hold the thought. Let me get another call here, another John, this one from Boston, Massachusetts. Boston, John, you're on the air in Boston.
Tom, how you doing? Listen, I'd just like to make two quick points, and this is just based off of my opinion from my own experience. I'm a former criminal attorney, and since switched to the real estate field.
Okay, good luck.
But I will tell you that, in my opinion, I don't know where, you know, it almost surprised me. I obviously know that jails and prisons are overcrowded, but in my experience, I never have seen people that have been convicted get sentences that they actually deserve.
You think we're still too lenient after all those people in jail?
I really feel that it is extremely lenient. And repeat offenders, people that have been charged and convicted even with serious crimes, oftentimes don't get put in prison. And, you know, this isn't a direct criticism of you, Tom, but just an analogy that you just made.
Yep.
in your opening statement, comparing, you know, the American prison system to a gulag. I mean, that is akin, in my opinion, of Dick Durbin calling American soldiers Nazis. I mean,
No, wait. I mean, all what I'm saying, John, I mean, we've got the world's highest rate and we've still got crime. Doesn't something seem odd about that?
You know what? I know this isn't going to be a popular statement, but build more prisons and build them larger. That's all I have to say.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
John, thank you for your call. All right. There's a lot out there. Glenn Lowry, come in with us. I want to go back to Minister Thomas Ellis. He's with us, still with us from Newark. And he says, look, we've got to look at ourselves. The responsibility is on the people. And he's talking about his neighborhood, and it's a minority neighborhood, a minority city. There was a time when that was, I mean, you've been through some big political swings in your life. There was a time when that was your line as well, that, you know, the underclass, the poor performance of students, unwed pregnancy, black-on-black crime, failures in black society itself, you said. Are you still saying that or something different?
Well, I'm not saying it here in the context of this discussion because we're talking about something else, although they are
black
related.
On black crime.
They are related. But you can't say, I mean, and with due respect to Minister Ellis, and I agree with him about the imperative to agency, about the issue of responsibility, about the fact that we have to raise our own children and we have to take control of what's happening in our communities. And I remember very well the response of ministers here in Boston when we had an episode of an uptick in youth violence and the ministers organized and they came out into the streets and so forth and so on. And it was very encouraging, very empowering and so on. And yet, there's only so much that community leaders can do because these are large social problems. Community leaders don't control the flow of weapons into the hands of potential criminals in their community. If we wanted to have serious gun control, that would take statutes. Community leaders don't have any budgets to invest in the development of young people in their communities. They can't raise taxes and such. These are public issues, and neither do they control the criminal justice system, the mandatory minimum sentences, the extent to which rehabilitation takes place behind bars. These are all matters of public policy.
So let's make it very clear then. Take the veil off your big theory. I mean, John's going after me for using the word gulag. Maybe it's too tough, but you are writing right here that something profound and racial is going on. As I read what you said we had racism, it was slavery, and then it was a kind of apartheid, and now we've turned the criminal justice system into a tool of racism, as I read you.
Well, I guess I put it, I remember Larry Summers, former president of Harvard University, saying with respect to the academic boycott of Israel, the controversial issue of should academics boycott Israel, that it was not anti-Semitic in intent, but perhaps it was anti-Semitic in effect, said President Summers. And I'm saying something like that about race. I'm saying I don't think the criminal justice system is a conspiracy of hooded Klansmen out to get black people, but I think the consequence of the way in which this policy has developed, with now 60% of high school dropout young black men under the age of 35 going to prison for a felony conviction sometime before their 35th year.
That's mind-blowing.
With the huge extent, this is the most this is the central public institution that deals with African-American men. I'm talking about the police and the prison system. The huge impact in the communities where young boys are growing up, where their role models are people who've just come back, buffed up from physical development in prison, tough, tattooed, gang members and such. The impact of this on the racial hierarchy in our society, the extent to which this mechanism reinforces and reproduces fault lines of race in our society is really quite telling. I don't think this is the way that we want to go.
Let's take a call from Tampa, Florida, then I'll come to you, Minister Ellis. But Anthony, in Tampa, you're on the air, sir.
Hi, how are you today?
Pretty well.
I think that there's a larger kind of context that, at least thus far anyway, that you're not talking about.
Okay.
That is, well, what, maybe 30, 35, 40 years ago, you know, cities like Newark and Detroit and Chicago were industrial centers where manufacturing jobs were plentiful, and post-World War II, African-American men, young African-American men could actually get those jobs.
Killed them, yeah.
I mean, they don't exist anymore. So, I mean, the conversation that I've heard thus far is, you know, how do you fight crime, right? How do you, is a more severe set of policies the way to go, or is it more aiming more toward rehabilitation? Is that the way to go? But you know, these problems didn't exist in the neighborhoods that we're talking about 30 and 40 years ago. Certainly not to the extent that they do today. And what gets lost, I think, in this conversation is what has happened in terms of economics. That has to do with globalization. That has to do with outsourcing. That has to do with all kinds of changes economically and politically.
Anthony, let us look at it. Thomas Ellis, Reverend Ellis, in Newark, well, what about it? A bunch on the table. First, Glenn Lowry says, you know, yes, you want to step up and do the right thing within your community, but there's a lot you don't control here. You don't control, for example, the flow of weapons in this country. So how far can you take it on your own? And what about the point made here from Tampa that, you know, without a stronger economy, you're kind of fighting an uphill battle?
Well, I want to address three of the concerns. I was writing something down.
Good.
One is, definitely, the racism that's in the prison industry, because now if people want to be for real about what's going on in this country, the prison industry is the new plantation. Now, don't take what I'm saying out of context. What I'm saying is now they're locking more people up so they can work for the prison system. Let's look at the disparity in cocaine sentencing, for instance. Now, we know white people sniff cocaine, black people sniff cocaine, a lot of different ethnic groups sniff cocaine.
Yeah, a lot of noses.
But now, here's the disparity. If the white person gets caught with powder cocaine, he may go to jail for 2 to 3 years. If the black person get caught with crack cocaine, he's going to jail for 15 to 20 years.
Would your neighborhood be better off if there were fewer crack cocaine prosecutions?
Well, here's the thing. Cocaine is cocaine. Crack is cocaine. So it's not no different drug. It's the same drug.
Well, I mean, do you just want to see more white faces in prison, or would your neighborhood actually be better off if there were fewer crack prosecutions?
No, what I want to see is equality straight across the board. That's the problem with the judicial system. There's no equality straight across the board. We can look at what happened to Vice President Gore's son.
Mm-hmm.
He's been busted 3 times for possession of marijuana.
100 miles per hour in a Prius.
And what's that?
But Tom,
to
you know, this
say?
Is one of the problems I have with progressives, and I count myself among those numbers.
Okay.
But I think we
got to
be more responsible when we make these arguments. I am writing this book about the future of criminal justice in
too
Washington
much justice.
Heights,
yep, yep.
New York,
mm-hmm.
where there's still open-air drug markets. And so I sit in my apartment and I make these nice academic arguments about equality and about how we really should decriminalize drugs. And
yep.
then I walk on the streets and I get accosted, literally, by drug dealers. And I feel unsafe. And I'm a 6'3" black guy.
Let me say this here. If you don't mind,
Minister Butler, Minister Ellis, we just got you for another minute, so let's hear it.
All right, so let me say this real fast.
Mm-hmm.
White people use drugs too. They may not stand on the corner; they're doing it in their basement.
Yeah, we know.
And
yep.
so the person who stands on the corner is no different from the person who uses a cell phone and say, "Meet me in my basement."
But Paul Butler doesn't feel good in that very neighborhood, and he's 6 foot plus.
I'm not threatened by the minister. Respectfully, I'm not threatened. I don't feel threatened by the guy in the cell phone or my friends who buy their drugs by having people deliver them. I do feel threatened when I try to walk down the streets of my neighborhood and I see guys selling drugs, and I think they probably have guns and something might break out, and I don't want to be in the middle.
Thomas Ellis, we just got you for 30 seconds more.
You need to stand up in your neighborhood and do something to make sure that isn't going on. That's the problem. We need more people standing up. You told me about the problem, but now what are you going to do about it? That's the issue.
Minister Thomas Ellis in Newark, New Jersey. He founded, founder and president of Enough is Enough, the coalition there in Newark. We wish you very good luck there.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking about crime and punishment in America, why we have jammed prisons and high-profile violent crime. Simple question here, is our jam-packed prison system working to create the society we want? Paul Butler joins us from New York. He's a former federal prosecutor, now professor of law at George Washington University, forthcoming book, Too Much Justice. Glenn Lowry is with us. He's a professor of economics at Brown University. Has an article in the latest Boston Review. Headline is, Why Are So Many Americans in Prison? Here's a line from that article. Our society, the society we have made, he writes, creates criminogenic conditions in our sprawling urban ghettos and then acts out rituals of punishment against them as some awful form of human sacrifice. Nate is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Nate, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling because I'm a teacher. I'm relatively new to teaching, and I had an opportunity this summer to work with African-American youths from the inner city here in the Boston area.
Great.
And one thing I was really shocked at was how the prison system affects them as young black men. Most of the men that they see in their communities have this in their background. It's sort of a rite of passage. Not only do these people have no criminal backgrounds, these kids who are good kids, they massively distrust the police. They see the criminal justice system as inherently racist, which also constricts what they see for themselves in the future. Just to give you an example, I was listening to a couple kids in my class talk before class, and they were talking about getting these shirts that say "Stop Snitching." You know,
yep.
You've heard about these?
Yeah, and this is to prevent people from testifying in crime, which has become a big problem in our justice
huge
system.
Problem. Yeah. And they were excited about what kind of shirt they were going to get, what the different designs they were going to get.
Even though there's been a rash of murder in their same neighborhoods?
Oh, yeah. That just shows you what happens when you take a huge swath of people from a given area. And, I mean, this is not, you know, kids from Arlington nearly as much as it's kids from Dorchester.
Let me ask you then, Nate, you sound like a white guy teaching in a black neighborhood, seeing this going on. So what's your perspective? Do you want to get more lenient on crime, maybe empty some of those prisons a little bit, or are you still in the lock-em-up category, or are you conflicted? How do you see it?
You've got to send some people into different programs. You've got to send them into drug treatment programs. You've got to send them into therapeutic programs. You've got to spend more on health care in those communities. You've got to spend more on education in those communities. You just, you know, you're going to have to put some investment in to get the kind of outcome you want. And hardcore prison only for for people who have proven themselves to be hardcore violent, hardcore recidivists. The other people, there should be outward bound opportunities, those kind of opportunities for younger people who have kind of taken the wrong track.
It takes a lot of money and a lot of care. I don't know if it's there, but we appreciate your perspective, Nate. Glenn Lowry, you get to sort of a bottom line here, and you say, I am not arguing that people commit crimes because they have no choices. But you say, my point is, society at large is implicated in an individual person's choices because we have acquiesced in social arrangements that sort of encourage that.
That's right. It's about responsibility, and maybe the key theoretical point I'm making in my article is that typically in this discussion, we repair to a position of personal responsibility. We say, they did the crime, they should do the time. We say, let's hold individuals accountable for what they've done. Now, this is necessary, and there's nothing wrong with it as such. However, it's an incomplete analysis of the problem, because while individuals, of course, have choices, those choices occur in contexts. So I ask you to put yourself in the position of a kid who grows up in one of these housing projects or one of these tenement buildings somewhere, where everywhere he looks, there's drug dealing going on and prostitution and burglary and robbery and such, where people do belong to gangs, where people are coming back and forth from the jailhouse, back to the community, back to the jailhouse, and so forth. Of course, that individual has choices. But it would require a certain kind of heroism to not be influenced at all in a negative way by all that what is going on around one. Now, when we, comfortable, middle-class, professional, relatively well-off, secure Americans, exactly, we sit back, we observe what goes on, we're afraid, we're disgusted, we want to do something about it. And when we don't look at how we in our own political and policy choices have helped to shape the environment within which such individuals, as I've been talking about, have matured, when we say we have no responsibility for it, when we put the responsibility entirely onto those persons,
you go to prison, period.
Then we are behaving immorally, I would argue. We are somehow not acknowledging the extent to which what we abhor going on over in the corners of society is an indirect consequence of decisions that we have made about how we are organizing our political economy. And we can make different choices. We can be more developmental in our orientation toward these populations. That is to say, looking for ways in which we can effectively contribute to the human development of people so that they make different choices than the ones that we abhor.
Are we too scared and angry to sort of loosen up a little bit and do that?
Yes, and also our politics rewards the one who can come out and say, I'm going to lock him up and throw away the key. I'm going to put him underneath the jail. And look at this one over here. He's liberal toward the criminals. He's willing to give them a second chance. Don't vote for him. Vote for me. We have that kind of politics going on.
And Tom,
yes,
know, I completely agree with Professor Lowry's theory, but I still need an answer from him and from other progressives about what I do when I look out my window and I see guys dealing drugs. And I know if I call the police in the long run, it's not going to do a whole lot of good, might even make things worse. But in the short run, it gets them out of my neighborhood, and that's what I want.
You know, if I may, let me bring another voice into this conversation right on this point. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Valencia Muhammad. She is a reporter for the Afro-American newspaper. She's also a founder of Mothers of Unsolved Murders, D.C. Two of her sons were murdered. Valencia Muhammad, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We heard you on Talk of the Nation the other day and your passion on this subject, and we thought we just got to include you in this big conversation. You heard Glenn Lowry just now saying the people whose response is to put criminals underneath the jail have got it backwards, have got the wrong emphasis. And yet, in my reading, I think you said exactly that after your sons your second son's murder, when it wasn't solved, I think you said we got to find the killer and put him underneath the jail.
I went to look for the killer. I and some other mothers with me went to look for the killer. I agree with Mr. Lowry. I also agree with the I think he's a district attorney.
Well, former federal prosecutor, Paul Butler, yes.
With the former federal prosecutor. Mm-hmm. First of all, as I look at it, the African-American community has never really understood how Oliver North and all of those drugs that were reported were allowed to come into our community, and they just seemed like raped our community, just threw this drug all around the United States, and how we were the victims, and we also served the time. Yet he was glorified, and for all the things that, you know, that happened. That was when the majority of the drug doses came into our community.
Who was glorified, Valencia? Who?
Oliver North, who worked for Reagan. Did everybody hold
Oh, them? You mean way back to Iran-Contra and, yeah, okay, okay.
That's when it all started for us in the 80s and the latter part of the 70s and the 80s when we just had drugs upon drugs thrust upon our community. It tore down our families.
I mean, Ollie North was a big name, but he certainly wasn't the biggest drug dealer on the planet.
He may not have been. You know, he was up with Reagan, okay? He got his orders from Reagan
but to help with
the Contra deal. Yeah. We never healed from that.
There was a flood, but take us to this point of what do you do? Do you step back and look at the big picture and say we've got to fix this on a broader level, or, to Paul Butler's point, when you've got that fear in your neighborhood,
first of all,
when you've got...
That's one of the, see, a lot of times what we see is that they're going for the little guys who have 0.5 grams of cocaine in their pocket, and they get a sentence for that and whatever, and it overcrowds the jails. But in the meantime, we're saying, look, the drugs are coming in from the Mexican border, they're coming in from South America, they may be coming in with some Chinese imports and all this other kind of stuff. Nobody's dealing with that on a larger scale.
Were your sons killed in drug-related murders?
No.
Okay, so...
No, but
so drugs weren't the issue.
I have to go. It's not about just my sons. Mm-hmm. When I speak for thousands of mothers around the country whose sons and daughters have been killed, and it's not drug related. A lot of times people think, oh, you know, there's just another black woman who doesn't want to take care of her children and her kids got caught up in some drug deal. That is not the case. In fact, the majority of the crimes here in the District of Columbia, according to their own stats, are not drug-related. They have a lot to do with emotionalism, people who, you know, are fighting with their own friends.
So do you want to see fewer prisoners or more prisoners or different prisoners or something else entirely?
Less and different, because it is time for us to stop looking the other way, Mr. Prosecutor. You know that I am not lying, and there was a gentleman who was on here before. I think he was a minister.
Mm-hmm.
It is time for us to look at the wrong things that white people do. Granted, Mr. Lowry, they may not be standing on the corner with the 45 of the guns and 9mm in the pocket with their pants hanging down, but I'd be doggone. They have a bunch of drugs, they're high as a kite, and they are able to live in high style in their communities, you know, and they're dealing the way that they do. It is time for us to stop only prosecuting and looking at people who are poor and just wiping them off because they irritate you. You don't want them in your community. At the same time, people who are living in pristine mansions and everything like that and well-off and half-million-dollar condos and million-dollar homes, they're doing their stuff too. Look at it from a different angle and arrest them so that all the drug trafficking can stop around the country.
Were your sons killed by white or black or brown killers or...
Black. Black.
Let's go to Sardis, South Carolina, and Nakumba. Nakumba, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Quick point.
Mm-hmm.
It just has to be more equality across the board with the prosecution of criminals. You have a guy that robbed the corner store because he can't pay his rent, and he gets 5-10 years. But then you have this big CEO that steals $400-500 million, and they give him 2-3 years or sometimes even a slap on the wrist in probation, which he's stealing from total America because the taxpayers end up footing the bills for these companies when they fold. You got to start at the top. You can't start at the bottom trying to sweep the little guy under the rug. These people are not eating. That's why they're selling drugs. That's why they're using drugs. They despair. We have to do something from the top down to start the program over.
Nakumba?
Well, I guess I don't understand why
locking up more white people will help the African American community. Again, that's why I'm not sure the problem is so much equality now. It's a big concern, but the more fundamental issue is that there are too many Americans locked up. And again, if it worked, if it actually made us safer, then I'd be all for it. But it doesn't seem to be working, and since it doesn't make us safer, I don't understand the solution of, well, let's do more of it. Let's just include white people.
But you're saying you're not comfortable with putting race so central to this conversation, Paul? I mean, you're African-American man yourself, I think.
Well, again, politically, I don't think it's going to get us anywhere because I don't think the white majority is too interested in racial justice. And I think there are other more effective ways to solve the problem. Again, Tom, you keep talking about more incarceration, less incarceration. How about just smarter criminal justice? It doesn't have to be about locking up people more, but it does have to be about making us safer and having fairer policies.
We've got a caller who I think is speaking directly to that. Let me go, if I may, to Bonnie in Boston. Bonnie, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm on a cell phone. Hope I don't break up. I'm actually on my way to a prison. I want to talk about another aspect of how our prison policy is increasing crime, and that's how we treat people when they're on the inside. At the same time that we started locking up an unprecedented number of people, huge, larger than any other Western nation, we also started taking away everything that makes life bearable for a large number of prisoners. We started deciding that programs were dispensable, contact visits, all kinds of things that just most of us take for granted in our daily life. We started putting more people in solitary confinement, hundreds and hundreds of citizens in this country.
Why do you think we did all that, Bonnie? Why do you think we did all that?
I think we did it because vengeance, because it was an unthinking response to crime, and I think it was politically convenient for the right to push this.
Glenn Lowry says we did it in part because a lot of prisoners were black or brown, and there's a racial angle to that. Do you agree or not?
Convergence of lots of things. They're overdetermined, maybe. But I think that this is, 97% of people still get out. The percentage of people in prison with mental illness has grown exponentially. They're not getting treated. They get released right out of 23-hour-a-day segregation. Imagine being in a cell 23 hours a day with a post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety.
And then on the street, Bonnie, you make a great point. I want to get one more call real quick. Mark in Clinton, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah,
I'd like to talk a little bit about just the system itself, too, is people end up going to prison as punishment, not to be punished. I spent 20 years myself in the system, and then the last 10 working with guys that are coming out.
20 years for what, Mark?
For homicide.
Yeah.
When I was a teenager.
Did it work?
Excuse me?
Did it work? Make you better?
If it worked, I'll say that I changed despite the system. Okay, I've made some changes, and I'm not here to bash the system, but I'll tell you what, they would never want me to be a warden of one of their prisons.
Why?
Because I would do it much, much differently. Rather than locking people down and persecuting them, I'd have them getting up early and doing significant jobs. I'd have them getting an education. I'd have them doing real things. As Bonnie just said, excellent points. 97% of these guys are getting out, and they're going to hit the streets. And here we are talking about all the political issues here and the racial issues, which are important, but there's bigger issues than that. This is a human issue, and the system is out of control.
Yeah.
What the system does to people is it creates criminals.
Mark, our time is very short. Thank you for your call. Valencia?
I agree with Mark. Of course, I know all of that, but I just wanted to interject an angle that's normally not there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do think that those criminals that are incorrigible, that just are going around and just having a field day killing people at will, need to be dealt with, put those people under the jail. However, for those individuals that really commit little small crimes and maybe get these big, large, prison sentences, I think that's very unfair. And the young lady who called is exactly right. People want jobs, significant jobs. They want jobs that pay not some $7.50. How are you going to buy a $450,000 home on a $7.50 hour?
You're not going to do it, and we know it. Valencia Muhammad, who lost two sons to murder in Washington, founder of Mothers of Unsolved Murders, D.C. We're out of time, but we appreciate your being with us and your thoughts. Thank you for joining us. Glenn Lowry, are we turning a corner here in this country in our understanding of the problem or not?
I don't know, although I do see some encouraging signs in a number of different places, including amongst evangelical Christians who have been more outspoken on this issue, and the talk about reform, about rethinking how we're doing criminal justice. I'm trying to be hopeful about it.
Glenn Lowry at Brown University, his article, essay in Boston Review is Why Are So Many Americans in Prison? Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Paul Butler, former federal prosecutor, now at George Washington University. Thanks for being with us, Paul.
Great to be here, Tom.
This is On Point.